We will now take questions. You'll see there is a microphone over there on your left, and if you would line up at the microphone, Mr. Solomon, I will be glad to answer your questions or respond to any remarks that you have to make. We'd appreciate it if you'd limit it to no more than 3 minutes. Thank you.
Mary, why don't you lead off for us? This is one of the exciting projects of which I've talked, Mary Abu Saba.
It's an honor to be here and to be here with this report. I was very moved by the words that you said. It's an honor for me is that having moved to Alameda just 2 years ago, and I immediately found the organization that started by Jeff Comfort, who is really an anthropologist, who is actually the founder of the concept of rebuilding homes of the Palestinians as an act of constructive resistance to the occupation. Our organization, now called the Rebuilding Alliance, is made up of Israelis, Palestinians, Americans, Jews, Christians, Muslims, secular humanists, whatever you might want to call yourself, but people who are committed to nonviolence, who are committed to ending occupation, and who are committed to rebuilding some homes in order to hold them up to the American public to see that each person, each country, each group of people, rather, has a right to a home, a homeland. I have put some films on the back table with the AFSC materials, AFSC and the Rebuilding Alliance. We co-sponsor with each other, work closely together, and I take the trek over to San Francisco to the meetings there. I put the video called On the Ground, Witness, Resist, Rebuild, which is shows Jeff Halper trying to talk the Israeli troops out of demolishing a home. It's a very dynamic film. It's along with Alan's films that he has a price tag of $20 a home. So I encourage you to buy them. My film is there, our film is there too, On the Ground, and the proceeds go to AFSC. Please take the film. Please also, as far as Alan was saying, remember, there are actions to take. What we mustn't do is just give up and say, oh, it's just so bad and awful over there. Yeah, it really is. It is bad and awful, and we have some choices here to make, chief of which is to educate ourselves about what's going on, to be bonded with the Israelis and the Palestinians over there who are working together fervently with a commitment to nonviolence, and that we take steps to bring that education to our congresspeople. We do have a voice. We find that every time we go to the congresspeople and say, this is the story, this is what's happening with home demolitions, 1,400 in Rafah just in the past year. In Rafah alone, 1,400 houses have been demolished. The congressperson always says, if you don't have a constituency behind you, it doesn't matter whether I agree with you or not. I might agree with you, but I'm not going to vote in that way until I know there's a constituency that will back me up. And that's the way it works here, and we all know it. And we do have some things to say about it, and we do have some power. On my sign-up sheet, which is right here in my hand, but I'm going to put it back on the table, I encourage you to sign up. You'll get more information about what we do. You'll have some direct access to learning more about our favorite way of raising funds for these houses is through house gatherings and showing our film. And summertime is a great time to do that. Here in Alameda, nice summer party. Invite your friends in, your families, and so forth, and show the video. Anyway, those are some actions you take, and I really encourage you to do this. And thank you very much, and thank you again, Alan.
a different framework, or could you clarify exactly? I don't quite understand the exact issue in terms of, is it just that it's not done properly and there's a proper way to do it, or is it really that there's no possible way to do it within the bounds of the rule that they made?
Well, you stated part of it, and that is the Israeli court rule that there is, the wall has to be done properly. They did not object building the wall in Palestinian territory. That is beyond the green line. What it objected to is causing undue inconvenience to the Palestinians who were involved. And it ruled that the military had to weigh all of the alternative possibilities and not create gross inconvenience for the Palestinians, and also needed to provide compensation, which has only been provided in a small number of the cases. Now, this leaves obviously a number of questions. What is a proper balance? So it stopped one section of the wall, if I'm not mistaken. It was about 20 miles in a 20 kilometers in a 30 kilometer section northwest of Jerusalem, which is very near Bidu, where I went with Rabbi Arad Ashman. There is a second course that questions another similar stretch. The assumption is that there will now be cases from Palestinians all along the wall, and incidentally some Israelis were included in this trip too, because some of the Palestinian towns are very close to Israeli settlements. And in some cases, they develop close links that they supply labor, they go to each other's shops, they go to each other's restaurants. So there were some Israeli towns that were parties to an essentially Palestinian case. And all of the wall now, in principle, is going to have to be reconsidered piece by piece, case by case. Now, it isn't clear what's going to happen when the new boundaries are drawn up for the wall to be redeployed, if you could redeploy a wall, which I don't think. How will this be approved? Or will it be subject to another round of court cases? So there is some feeling in some circles in Israel that this is the end of the wall, that it will get so tied up in changes that will be too costly, and so much litigation that it will take so much time that it will become counterproductive. Now, in that light, the decision of the International Court of Justice adds a great deal of weight. It goes a step farther than the High Court goes, but it says what many people think the High Court may have been thinking, but was very worried about the political repercussions of making such a decision. And there is also a possibility that the decision of the Israeli High Court came before a part of the High Court, that they may call all, I think, 11 members of the High Court together eventually for a final decision on this. So on the whole, I look on this as being a very exciting and helpful development, and a time for people to speak up and support. You want to follow that up for them?
Yeah, I had one other wall-related question. Was it correct that I hear, I don't know if this was Ralph Nader saying this, that Kerry made a comment that the wall decision should not be in the International Court? Did you hear that, or did anybody hear that?
No.
Some people heard that too. Yeah.
He did make a highly heralded statement about Americans and Israeli puppets, not making it very clear.
It was in that conversation with Amy Goodman that I think he said that Kerry mistaken that it had no right to be in the International Court either.
If he hasn't said it, I wouldn't be surprised if that doesn't get said at some point by any one of the number of people. David, please. Come on up. Tell us who you are.
Okay, I'm Marion Baldwin. And my interest is, if you say that there are a lot of American Jews that are against what is going on in Israel, why isn't there more vocal, and the media seems to be so slanted as to what the information that we get? someone saying you disagree. So I'm saying what I can't reconcile the two as to what kind of movement. I mean, if I, you know, some of the groups that I've seen films, you know, maybe produced some years ago, that where people were trying to show how the Palestinians were treated, but I don't see them that much. You know, maybe you see it on Frontline or some, you know, Palestinian photographers being shot at. But it seems like such a disservice, you know, to the Jewish community that somehow, you know, that the media isn't trying to enlighten us all.
Well, this isn't the first time, Mary, that problem has come up. For years, and by that I mean for at least 25 years to my knowledge, the American Jewish Committee has undertaken an annual poll, and whenever it asks a question of American Jews how they feel about the West Bank and the occupation, the answer is a resounding no. And know that we do not support the occupation and the settlements. And by resounding, I mean in the range of 80 to 85%. Something gets lost in translation, though, and I think it's like the mood that existed in the early days of Vietnam, but it's been a much longer, more extended period for American Jews. And that is, when is it appropriate to say to dissent publicly? When will you not get vilified or jeopardize yourself? So I find myself regularly lobbying Congress people and talking to rabbis, and they pat me on the back and they say, God bless, keep it up, keep working, show me that you can bring hundreds or thousands of people of support to me, and I will be there. But I want you to know until then I'm going to pat you on the back and denounce you. So my life for the last 30 years has been a thing, if anyone knows the phrase Shabbos Goy, the person, the non-Jewish person, Jews get to help out running their errands on the Sabbath when they cannot work. Basically, saying the kinds of things that most Jews believe but are afraid that if they say them publicly, others will say, well, gee, that is going to be picked up by the anti-Semites. And that's going to be used against us, and we're going to be hurt. And I think we've come to the point now where the greatest purveyor of anti-Semitism is the government of the state of Israel. Because it is creating a state to which Jews do not want to come. And that was the whole idea of Zionism, a place where Jews do not only want to come, but feel safe. And I would just add to that, there have been a number of Jewish sources recently that have elaborated on that, that have denounced that kind of approach. There are a number of Jewish groups, many of them right here, like Tikkun and Jewish Voice for Peace, who were mentioned in the Nation article, who finally said, we have to speak up, we have to be a voice crying out in the wilderness. The Union of American Hebrew Congregations has started to criticize the occupation. There have been lobbying by Jewish groups in opposition to AIPAC, the American Israel Public Affairs Committee. Former Rabbi Henry Sigmund, formerly the head of the American Jewish Congress, has been writing marvelous articles on how there needs to be unilateral withdrawal of the Israeli military from the occupied territories. The problem is that all of these aren't heard because they are up against so much money and such a pattern of history that they think that their voices won't be heard, and I believe they will. And we are on the cusp of that becoming a tidal wave. And my greatest concern right now is not whether there will be a change in attitude. My fear is that those who love Israel so much they are willing to love Israel to death will prevent a dialogue so long that it will greatly help the anti-Semites because we will fall into the caricature that they're making of us.
Yeah, I was just going to say my daughter had a client who was saying, yeah, we shouldn't be there, but if I said this in New York, they'd kill me. So it's that kind of fear of coming out and being honest, which all of us have in various situations, you know, whether we're politically correct or how it's going to be interpreted. But I just think it's a real shame that's not helping anything.
No, we'll look back one day and chuckle at all of this. There's going to be some pain yet. David, where did they go?
Yeah, Alan, first I want to thank you for your rewarding talk, but you know, this is a subject that Art Lippold brought up actually last October in a discussion. The neoconservatives have really shaken up the Middle East a lot. I mean, they unleashed a storm. The idea that, for instance, Saudi Arabia would have a split in its leadership enough to essentially drive all the Americans out of there is incredible. And actually, my understanding is the United States has twisted Jordan's arm to the point where Jordan may enter Iraq on the side of the occupation forces, which would set off a storm. What I'm trying to say is that rather than talk about peace, what we may be looking at in the short run is an expanding war where there are a number of strategic targets that could absolutely destroy the world economy. Not destroy it, but take enough of a shock that would make, for instance, the attack on the World Trade Center when we're small. There's oil centralization areas, I forget what they were called, that are extremely vulnerable. There's all the water purification plants up and down the Gulf. And we could be looking at a very serious expanding conflict. Has there been a lot of discussion about this? I mean, am I the only one? I know I can't be the only one that's observed this. When you go over to the Middle East recently, have people been talking in these terms at all?
Quite a bit, David. Anyone can only say so much, but I was quite struck by, first of all, the criticism of U.S. policies, first with Sharon's visit to Bush, and then with Abu Ghraib and everything else that's happened. We have never, I don't recall in my lifetime anyways, as much anti-Americanism, coherent, thoughtful from respectable quarters as there is right now. We have alienated the larger portion of our friends. These discussions are constant, and the main ones are, trust to rely on the United States at all. And the very fact that so few nations have joined the United States, and some of you have probably seen Fahrenheit 9/11, Michael Moore's movie where he talks about the coalition of the willing, of Laos, and other great nations. He did skip a few of the larger ones, which I think was unfortunate. But I don't think the Jordanians are remotely contemplating going in. We may disagree on this, but
I just heard.
Abdullah's getting such intense pressure for being as American as he is right now because all of our allies, Mubarak and others, are starting to cut back and apologize because we put them in a terrible way. I would like to think this would be a learning experience that would help us out. And this relies on two things. One, that we will have a new president. And secondly, the new president will be better than the old president.
Both are
good
reasons. I'm Barry Schuss.
Barry?
Yeah. And I have family in Israel. I've been there since 1910. Also, other family. And I've been to Israel a few times, and I have obviously a lot of feeling for the country and the people. After saying that, I am very worried about a number of influences which I see not only amongst the Israelis, but also amongst the Palestinians and the Arabs. You mentioned it in the first person, but I've heard mentioned that you have Israelis beginning to behave in an overtly fascist, even possibly Nazi type way.
Okay. Very, very close to your mouth. So what
I'm saying is that you have touched on a factor. There's been a lot of post-World War II immigration into Israel-Palestine. There was a strong connection at the various elite levels between Palestinians and some Nazi interests during World War II. So on both sides, you have this influence. I remember a play back in the 60s called The Man in the Glass Booth, in which it was supposed to have been something like Eichmann. But in fact, it was every man who had been through, every Jew, so to speak, who had been through World War II, who, in the secrets of his life, put on a Nazi uniform. Okay, I'm exaggerating that just to point out, though, that these influences exist in Israel. And if you combine that with this fundamentalist religiosity, which you haven't mentioned, but which is at the base of the politics in Israel. And finally, I'm a Southern Africa scholar. A lot of similarities with South Africa. A lot of the aspects of apartheid, a lot of territorialization, separation, building walls, and yet using the labor and trying to figure out where it's a settler state as well, settler colonial state. You have all of these factors. It's very difficult for anyone to imagine that we can existentially try to bring about a peace between these groups. And I think President Clinton, for all of his faults, and we know what they are, came as close as anybody did. And so now when people talk about the Geneva Accord, the recent Geneva Accord, there's a deep sense, pervasive sense of pessimism about it. Do you understand what the feeling that I have about that, and what is your comment to it?
Thanks, Eric. Well, let me start from this point. You all probably detected some optimism on my part, and it's true. And it's there because Jews and Palestinians did live together in relatively peace for many, many years. And even after that ripped apart, out of the efforts to bring dialogue about between the Israeli government and the PLO, the peace community on both sides also developed, once again, good relations with each other. Many of the people who have been negotiating together are people who I and the American Friends Service Committee brought together, the neutral sites like Athens and Cyprus and others over the years to introduce them to each other. To this day, there are very fond memories that people have, some going back to the 30s and 40s, some going back to the 60s and 70s. It is, I think, nothing short of miraculous that Israel has not turned into another Algeria. For all of the terror that has taken place, it could have been much worse over these years of the conflict having continued for half a century. So I think that there is a wellspring of good feeling that is exhaustible, but continues and can be tapped if there is reason to hope. And it goes up and it goes down. There's also another thing that unifies the Middle East as a region too, and that is outside intervention. The United States makes a good target, but also it makes a good foil when you want to make peace to have the United States say something has to be done because it takes the heat off of local leadership too. So there are a number of approaches. I don't share as much of good feeling about Clinton as you do. I'm still back with Carter and some others. I think Clinton purposefully blew it, and his immediate aide on the Middle East, Robert Maley, said that much in articles after he resigned because of his deep disappointment. So the situation could indeed be much worse. I don't think that we can continue that long and hope that that kind of hope will continue, especially given the economic malaise and what has happened now in Iraq, the
beliefs that by the Israeli government that Iran now has nuclear capacity, which sound remarkably like its accusations that Iraq has nuclear capacity not so long ago. I think there will be very great pressures, well, maybe not so great, but they will be there from the Quartet, from the United Nations, from the European Community, in light of seeing that America is the king without clothes. So it's going to be very harder for us to rationalize our way out of it. But what I really do think that we need is, because we can't always go back and say, you know, only the governments would act in a different way, everything would be fine, is we have to be so intimidated and cowed and speak up as Jew and Muslim and Christian and Zoroastrian working together and say, we have to do something. And so the responsibility effectively is ours as much as it is anyone else.
I just want to say that I have only in the past week seen photographs of the wall from any perspective where I actually could see it snaking around in the countryside. And I was horrified. And I'm surprised that we haven't seen photographs before in the mass media. And I think that if those photographs are well publicized, it's going to turn most of the people in the United States against what Israel is doing, against the wall, and Israel is going to lose even more sympathy than they've lost already, because that wall is an abomination.
Well, a couple of quick things. One, if you want to see the wall, watch BBC, those of you who get cable. If you don't get cable, the International Solidarity Movement, which is active in the Bay Area, has copies of a book put out by PENGON, the Palestinian Environmental Non-Governmental Organizations, which goes into great detail about the war, and is worth the investment of about $20. We also have a videotape about the wall back here by Israeli-Dutch filmmaker Benny Bruner, which includes extensive interviews with the man who's in charge of building the wall. And it's very enlightening to hear from his own lips exactly why he was doing it and what they were trying to accomplish. The Jewish Film Festival coming up will also have some great films, I think four or five of them, over at UC Berkeley at Wheeler Auditorium. I'm sorry I don't put the dates offhand. I know the ones in San Francisco, and we'll be happy to give those to you. But I do want to say one thing, and that is, don't become anti-Israel. And I wouldn't tell my Jewish friends to become anti-Palestinian. Find a way in which you can bring both together and affirm the legitimate rights of both sides. It isn't a matter of choosing between one and the other. They have to live together. Now, no one's attacked me or asked some really tough questions. Can I?
Here comes one. This is not a tough question. This is just for my own interest. I'm curious, when I look at the map now of the wall, the West Bank, there are so many settler settlements out there. And when I was in Israel in the late 70s, there was an inflow of settlers, especially from New York. And I'm wondering now, are there still settlers coming into the country? Is there still immigration into Israel? Where are they coming from?
Well, there are still settlers coming into Israel, not a lot, mind you. It's a period in which I think the latest statistics show that last year, as opposed to recent years, there was a slight gain versus the number of people that went out, because a large number of people are leaving Israel because they don't want their children raised under the threat of terrorism. There have been a modest immigration continuing from the Soviet Union, but the Israelis have had difficulty figuring out really who is a Jew and who isn't a Jew. So that immigration has been about a third or more non-Jewish, namely spouses that don't technically qualify. And then you've got a few really odd groups like Indians and Peruvians who have been claiming that they're Jewish. And the government has been turning a very favorable eye towards almost anyone who claims they're Jewish, because most emigres are shunted to the West Bank and Gaza, where they have subsidized housing and benefits, and most of them have virtually no money to make it possible. So we were at the settlement of Ephrata one day talking to an old-time friend, Artie, who we've worked with. And someone walked by and he went over and said, just a minute, I want to bring this guy to you. We had to use a Spanish translator. This was a person from a group of Peruvians who had claimed some ancient link to the Jewish people and had been incorporated into the three settlements on the West Bank. So this all gets back to the question of Israel settlement policy, and that is the policy has been not merely to populate the West Bank as quickly as possible and to have possession of the strategic areas and the resources, but to create those settlements in precisely a way that would prevent there ever being an independent Palestinian state. So the idea of the wall doesn't make sense to begin with. These settlements were created in a way to exercise total control over the Palestinians and all of their resources. And now the wall is meant to encompass all of these little settlements throughout the West Bank that are linked up by roads and communications and water, and it can't be done. So I think I'm clear on what I said. But is there more to your question?
Yeah, I just remember the whole sector thing was very aggressive when I was there. And is that still the case? It's still a very
strong. Oh yes, it's very much increased. And first of all, understand about 80% of the settlers, people will give you different figures on this, are economic settlers. They have only gone to these settlements because they get subsidies from the government, and the government is not building very much in the way of new housing in Israel because it wants to encourage those settlements. About 15 to 20% are people who are part of what's called the settlers' movement. And the better part of these believe that God gave us the land and we're going to be here till hell freezes over. So the scandal now in Israel is that some of the settlers and the leaders of settler groups are saying, we are prepared to take up arms against the Israeli army. We are prepared to kill Jews if necessary for the sake of God and what God gave us. And there are rabbis who are now arguing with rabbis who are trying to convince the more militant that this might not be the best thing for Israel, let alone for Judaism and the Jewish people.
I'm not Palestinian or Jewish, but I'm an American taxpayer. Could you say more about U.S. economic assistance to Israel and whether that's linked to the wall at all?
Well, first of all, everyone should know that the United States provides direct aid or aid credits for Israel of a little over $3 billion a year, the most that it provides to any other nation on earth, not even taking into account the amount of money that comes on a per capita basis, which makes it far, far larger. Officially, the money does not go directly to the settlements. In fact, Israel is instructed not to direct money towards the settlements, but Israel does not have to account for what it does with that money. So the simple truth is that no one knows. But the money that the United States provides or in terms of military credits certainly does not make life in the West Bank more difficult for the Israelis. And of course, most of the weapons used, the Black Hawk helicopters, the rockets that are used to suppress the Palestinians are from the United States, but there are arms credits. In the very few cases the government has connected settlement aid to our aid, that is, we said whatever Israel expends in the occupied territories will be deducted from the amount of aid provided by the State Department, it is replaced, as we talked about a little earlier, by Congress. That just happened, as a matter of fact, recently. So the United States, for all of its efforts to find fine lines, has been very helpful. But I think, to answer your question much easier in a simpler way, the United States has simply never said
the settlements in the occupied territories are wrong. It's come close to it years ago. Actually, President Reagan, I think, was the strongest president I remember in terms of the settlements. I think, money aside, if the United States government would just say, these settlements are wrong, they are counterproductive for peace, they are embarrassment to the state of Israel, money or no money, it would send members of the Knesset scurrying so fast, it would make their heads spin. It would help, for instance, if the United States would merely, when a resolution comes before the United Nations that suggests that the settlements are wrong or that we need to speed up the evacuation of settlements, that the United States not veto it instead of protecting Israel. It's like an extremely indulgent a child with a mother that cannot say no. I hope I'm not sexist for that, so I apologize.
Before I make my comment or question, I'm not sure what which it is, I just want to say that it's very important, I'll don't take it off my time, AFSC to support the work of the American Friends Service Committee and to make donations to the American Friends Service Committee. They have, I think they do marvelous work. And I hope that you will support them, get in touch with them, join the committee. Alan hasn't given his organizational pitch, so I'll do it for him. So it's really important. I think this talk is an example of the kind of thing that it's possible. Let me say, I'm a little bit more sort of agitational than Alan, but agitated as well about what is going on there. And I think that Alan has touched upon so many things that I can comment on. The danger of a war, if Bush is reelected, I think he may take it as a mandate to go to war. With Iran or against Iran. The Israelis may decide to bomb whatever there is in the way of an Iranian nuclear effort, which I think probably does exist. Of course, the Israelis have a nuclear weapon. We've only begun to touch on that. And I have put on the back table some cuttings about this issue. Mohammed El-Moraidi has just been in Israel. Very important. This is a dangerous area. And when we think about the Middle East, think not simply Israel, Palestine, that's that word. You have to think about the greater Middle East. That's the Brzezinski's term, and then in Central Asia as well. There's a complicated game being played out there, and the Israeli political leadership is part of that game. And it's no accident that Netanyahu was here lobbying for a war against Iraq. I think it's just shameful that happened, and the American Jewish leadership, I say leadership, and this goes to a question that was asked here, to all the organizations supported and agitated for a war against Iraq. Now, this goes to a very fundamental point. It's like the Christian movement. The tiny minority has hijacked the Christian movement. It's extremely important. And the same thing is true in the case of American Jews. And that's why the Nation article is so important. It's opened that up for the first time, and to show that they hijacked it. And of course, they use these bully tactics of calling anybody who objects to it anti-Semites and self-hating Jews, etc., etc. You've all heard that. And one of the reasons for this meeting, in a way, is to start to turn the tide against that kind of thing. Very important. I've fought with this kind of thing. It used to be when you mentioned the Gulag or the slave labor camps in Russia, communism, communists, oh, you're a fascist because you do this. Well, I'm tougher than that, and you simply hit him in the nose. So, but it's important, and I think it does go to American politics. I'm sorry, it is deeper than simply why these bully tactics work. What is the vacuum in American politics? Why are those tanks, American tanks there, and American gunships there? It's actually shameful. And it has to do with this terrific vacuum. And even now we have John Kerry waffling on this important issue. We have got to create an alternative American politics. And it's extremely important, I think, for American Jews not to be the target of this. I regard the American Jewish leadership, this tiny fraction of people. They're not a big group. They are the right wing, tons of money. They use that money, AIPAC. They capture there's something called the Jewish Community Relations Councils and so forth. They claim to speak for Jews. They don't at all.
They have absolutely no right to speak on this issue, because nobody voted to make them. They speak for the right wing, from a good point of view. And it's important to recognize that and call them on it. We say, who the hell do you speak for? You don't speak for anybody. Nobody voted to do this. AIPAC is another example. I read AIPAC bulletins like that. I read everything I possibly can. And I read these AIPAC bulletins, and now they're calling for war on the run. That's where they're headed. Okay? So the vacuum is here in the United States. We've got to create another alternative politics. And frankly, to save the Israelis, to save the Jews, and we have to have that alternative. I could go on, of course, I'm not the secret idiot. So, but I really urge you to read about this. There's a lot to read, an alternative point of view. You can read the Jewish Forward, which I think is a terrific newspaper. You can read the alternative currents. You can read the should read the right-wing Jewish paper, like a commentary, the magazine published by the American Jewish Committee, shamefully enough, it has an article in defense of torture in the current issue. That shames all Jews, it shames all everybody. So you've got to read this kind of thing. There's Haaretz in English. You can buy it, go down to Afikomen, the Jewish bookstore, and get Afikomen and read. The debates that take place in Israel are far more complicated and far more would be unacceptable in the United States. Anyway, Alan has given a terrific talk, and I talked too long. I abused the chairman's
chairperson.
You're fired.
Are there any other questions?
Well, Art has stimulated a couple of quick comments. The first is AFSC's Middle East program, which I direct, tries to be a guidance and reflex. We have an office at 9th and Market in the city, and we're always happy to entertain requests for information, literature, support, people who want to stop the line. Secondly, is from time to time, we work with other groups like the Fellowship of Reconciliation and have tours to the Middle East. If any of you want to have a great political tour, we have staff in the Middle East. We work closely with them. I led one the first couple of weeks of this tour, and there's a brochure back there. On the table is a white and black brochure of about a dozen, 15 Israeli and Palestinian groups we encourage you to support. We're not asking for your money, although we're always happy to take it, but help them out. Pick out an organization that appeals to you and give them a little publicity to support. And I'll try and put this in the back in a minute or two if any of you want to be on our regular mailing list. Having said that, there is in the community, and they're tied very closely to Afikomen, a Jewish congregation called Gehilah, which for over 15 years has formally supported the idea of an Israeli and Palestinian state. And they've recently done a statement called Brit Shalom, Covenant of Peace, based on the works of Martin Buber, which is an appeal to all of the congregations in Northern California to enter into dialogue for peace. How do we get out of the terrorism and how do we get out of the violence? I didn't bring copies with me, but I'm happy to send them to you, and all you have to do is go to kehila.org and you'll find it. K-E-H-I-L-L-A, I hope.
Yes, that's
right. Thank you, David. And anyway, it's there, and it's really good. It's good to inspire you to share with some of your friends in the Jewish community. Any last? Okay.
My name is Russell Kirk. I'm just curious, how effective do you think the witness program in the International Solidarity Movement is?
Well, there are two programs. One is the accompaniment program of the World Council of Churches out of Geneva, which our organization is helping out, and our staff and Jews who is helping to train. It's a terrific program. And basically what it does is it builds on an earlier program, and that is the program for many years that's been going by CPT, the Christian Peacemaker Team, which had been limited to Hebron and is now expanded. So both they and the accompaniment team are doing work. And then there's the International Solidarity Movement, all of which provide witnesses, which report human rights violations, which try and intercede, which are a part of the group that Rachel Corey, who died at the hands of an Israeli bulldozer in front of the doctor's house, who was decidedly not a terrorist and not heavily committed to politics. The
I think a sign that the accompaniment program and all of the various permutations have succeeded is that the Israelis have tightened up on people getting in. If they have any reason to believe someone's involved in one of the organizations, they're stopped at the airport. And all of these cases, the Israelis say, well, you know, it's a bunch of ragamuffins. It's kind of like the old days during the Vietnam War. You know, it's all communists and outside agitators and so forth. So don't pay any attention. It's having a tremendous impact. It's really building bridges. It has created important dialogue with Israelis. There are soldiers that we know who have decided to become refuseniks, not to serve in the occupied territories because they've been impressed by the young people who have gone over there from America and interceded in front of armed people. There's a strong feeling that the reason that Ariel Sharon is talking about disengagement from Gaza is that because behind the scenes, and we're trying hard to get the statistics, so many Israelis have refused to serve in Gaza that he wanted to cut his losses before there was a really great scandal. So people who take these efforts are doing some of the most exciting work around, and they really deserve our support and attention. I think there was one more quickie. Yes.
Another court question. As the Israel Supreme Court, this looks really law say about collective punishment as it's been meted out through the destruction of Palestinian homes and policies on families.
The Israeli High Court has not ruled on collective punishment. If it ruled, I would suspect that it would support collective punishment, because on the one hand, the Israeli courts uphold anything that is favorable to security, because the courts do not believe that they have the right, as opposed to the military, to determine what is secure for Israel. Now, it might have something that would help it out if Israel had a constitution or a Bill of Rights that would help give a suggestion of what was worthwhile and what not, what was legally enforceable. But Israel does not have a constitution or a Bill of Rights. And that's something that's being worked on. It's been worked on for years. It's become a shaggy dog story. Having said that, you've given me the opening. There's a Palestinian group in Ramallah called Al-Haq, which we helped spread many, many years ago. It was started by the Palestinian attorney Raja Shahade, who's been at UC Berkeley and spoken various times. Marvelous guy. Good taste in all parts, too. And Al-Haq has just begun a collective punishment campaign. It has folders. I think I may have some at the office that I could share with you if you're seriously interested. It will probably send a team of speakers around the United States this fall, and the Palestinians have targeted this issue. I find it demeaning that they have to be put in such a position to say that you should not weigh collective punishment on us. We shouldn't weigh a lot of things on them. So anyone who's interested in that, please.
We're pursuing collective punishment philosophies in Iraq now.
Sure.
It's a convenient way to go, sure.
Can I just say
and you will be our dessert and then we'll adjourn on and talk in for a moment.
As we all know, peace for both sides and both sides win is maybe what this place is all about and what we'd like to really have happen over in Israel and Palestine, and certainly in the Middle East and around the world. But I do want to say in regard to Palestine and Israel, it was within the Palestinian covenant that they were going to be annihilating the Jew. They did not have the right to exist. So of course, as our gentleman here was talking about, the Oslo Accord happened, and he said, yes, in all respect, Arafat, they do have a right to exist. The other faction, all these other groups that were radicals, which of course the Palestinian authority also was a radical, did speak up. In regard to KNESSET, the Knesset, the right wing, It was also Sharon, isn't it not so, that also Sharon did not go along with them. He said, yes, we are not, we're going to dissolve these settlements. And also, I think some of the issues here that you spoke about in regard to, there's like 4 million, isn't there 4 million Palestinian refugees? And there's also refugees on the Israeli side as well, caused by both the 1967 and the 1948 disbursement because of the wars. And I guess my question is really, really this. We do have right, there's right sides, there's a main between them, there's a right side. But I think as far as establishing Israel, as far as establishing Palestine, I don't think that's the issue. We know that they're going to be there. They have the right to have their home. I think maybe the issue may be as far as water, Jordan River. There's so many issues over there I think Israel was the one that built the water. What is it? They established the carrier of water, and they were going to be. And so they're concerned about the water over there as well. Also, even though this is not an issue for America, let anybody come any place. Let them come here to any state they want, any state in America they want to go to. But they are asking this question because they're so small. They want to know if we don't even think like this. Well, sure, let the immigrants, I think immigrants have a right to be free. They shouldn't be occupied. I'm very much for that. But who's going to support them all? Again, that shouldn't even be an issue. They have to raise the money. If people work, I do agree with that. So I think there's more here than what we're discussing. There's a question. I have all these questions for you. I don't know the other side. I wasn't in Israel. I wasn't in the Middle East at all to answer some of these latest news questions. But I wasn't able to sit here and listen to think that, the regime of America, Jews, and also the regime that's over there, obviously trying to negotiate some sort of peace there. I think there's a mainstream and, of course, the right wings of both sides and left wings. Thank you.
Well, let me just touch on a couple of things quickly and say I hope you'll take my course at Cal sometime, PAX 135, on peacekeeping, peacemaking in the Middle East. Just starting from the back, there's been a split recently in the major national Jewish organizations. And what the split has been about is whether to support Sharon, who's very much a man of the right, and certainly more conservative than George W. Bush, or whether to oppose Sharon because he is willing to compromise too much and give up some settlements. And that has been seriously debated by AIPAC and the other national Jewish organizations. You can read about it in the foreword, which Art has back there. But Sharon remains to this day the architect of the settlements. He devised the settlement policy as Minister of Agriculture. That's one of the reasons people aren't sure what's going to happen with the disengagement, because the Americans want him to give up the settlements. And so far, he's taken down several. But the odd thing is that the settlements all of a sudden reappear a couple of days later. So there has been a net gain in settlements since the negotiations have started. So I wish I could say something more optimistic about Sharon, and we all have to hope for the better. As far as the refugees were concerned, the Palestinian refugees were at the hands of the Israeli military. And the Israelis need to bear some, not all, but some significant responsibility for what happened to the refugees. And there's been a lot of work done on this. I won't go into the work of Betty Morris, the Israeli historian, but we have a tape called Al-Nakba, which uses entirely Israeli sources, which documents what happened to the Palestinians in 1948. The refugees from the Arab countries went out either because those Arab governments drove them out, or because the Jewish agency was extremely anxious to get new refugees to the land so it would increase its army and its political position. Both of those are issues that have to ultimately be dealt with, but they were No matter how you look at it, there's no one I've met on the face of the earth that believes the Palestinians were any way responsible for it. And they should not have to bear that burden. Finally, as far as the Palestinian state is, I've spent a good portion of my life since 1974 arguing for an independent Palestinian state. I have been bitterly opposed by the National American Jewish leadership, ridiculed by that idea. Israelis and Palestinians we have brought to the United States who have been very determined to have a peaceful state living with each other, side by side, collaboratively, have been vetoed by those organizations and programs and canceled. That is just starting to change, only at the beginning. The state of Israel has yet to state as a matter of policy that we accept the idea of an independent Palestinian state. That comes from George Bush, not from anyone in the current Israeli government. I wish it did. And such a statement by Israel would be one nonviolent way of appealing to the Palestinians and leaving them with the impression that there is something that they could have for hope. Let me just say one more thing about the state, and that is we have a sense how Israel envisions a Palestinian state by the agreement that Israel is proposing to disengage from Gaza. Israel is willing to withdraw all of its troops from Gaza, okay? But it reserves the right to send its troops back in anytime Israel believes or perceives that there is a need to have those troops there, right there, wrongly. It must have control of water, of borders, ports, and all immigration and shipping in and out. Basically, it will be an Israeli enclave or bounty stamp.
You have it without a state. As far as Palestine without a state, but I'm saying that as far as the borders, as far as water goes, they established the carrier of water.
The source of water for all Palestinians and all Israelis is Nekarot. That's Hebrew, and that is the name of the Israeli water company. All water and all electricity is controlled by Israel right now. So any state would be